Welcome to Zero Downtime, the new podcast brought to you by DCD's editorial team in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical infrastructure provider.
Vertiv has kept the world's leading businesses connected for more than 50 years. We build, deliver, and support critical infrastructure that's available, sustainable, and future-ready. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Welcome to this DCD Fireside Chat, Navigating Data Center Construction and Resilience in the Midst of Power Instability. That's a longish title to unpack, but basically I'm talking to Neil Kalita, who is Senior Director for Power and Energy at NTT Global Data Centers, about what data centers need to be doing around power at the moment in Europe. There's a massive take-up of power coming, and pretty much any location you can think of in Europe, they're starting to have to think about how they can get enough power to the data centers that are planning to be built there. Neil has been looking at this issue in great detail for NTT, so I think we need to bring him in. Hello, Neil. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, Peter. Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Great. Okay. Well, I think, you know, given what we've seen in places like Frankfurt and Dublin and London and Amsterdam, and you can mention more ones, I'm sure, we've really got to a stage where the amount of data center capacity in given metros is such that they actually have to start interacting with the rest of the world. And we're maybe getting towards some sort of a social agreement. And we're certainly seeing regulations coming. What's your take on big picture there?
Yeah, I think the low carbon transition is actually what's driving a lot of the pressure. And I think what we're seeing is that the networks, the power networks, have not really kept up with investment to facilitate that transition. And by transition, I mean not just the transition to renewables, which is creating volatile supply from wind and solar, etc., but also the sort of electrification of heat for residential, and also the electrification of transport, so EV charging and the like. So I think all of that is putting a lot of pressure on the network. Points of connection are congested. And generally, I think what we're seeing is that there's been some chronic underinvestment for the last couple of decades for an issue that hasn't really, just suddenly popped up. It's been around for a while, climate change. So I think, part of the issue is infrastructure and network operators, lack of investment. I think we have started building bigger data centers, obviously. The demand from those other sectors that are driving that. I think the legislation, and to answer the question towards a social contract, I think the key legislation that's really almost driving that now is the new German energy efficiency law, which is far-reaching in its scope. And I think it does drive towards a social contract, is our read of it as well. And that social contract operates on a couple of aspects. I think if we take the from a community perspective, clearly there's the heat reuse aspect and the idea of taking our waste heat and plugging it back into district heat networks or sharing it with local consumers potentially. And I know the UK in London, they're also looking at that kind of solution as well. And then I think the other really interesting one is the fact that for the public reporting of PUE, et cetera, it means that operators and clients alike, that relationship is going to have to evolve to look at more aspects of utilization planning and utilization forecasting, and to actually have a grown-up dialogue around that on a regular basis to see where the customer's utilization forecasts are. And from the operator perspective, what does that do to the PUE, and how do we actually explain that to the regulator as to why PUE is where it's at? I think the legislation is quite interesting in that it doesn't actually mention utilization when linked to PUE. It just assumes that we'll all get to 1.03 or whatever it is just magically and completely dislocated from how the centre is actually being used. I think the other real challenge is going to impact PUE decreasing is going to be the environmental context, i.e. weather, the ambient temperatures and other weather patterns as well, which are obviously in the process of changing. And so sometimes we may see a plant running a lot harder than is required. And, you know, we're seeing the age of the 100-year storms and temperatures now coming much, much more frequently. So these are all aspects which are going to impact. So the social contract I think we have is with those sorts of stakeholders. And I think also with a wider stakeholder, as some of the moratoriums in other cities have shown, is that communities are pushing back at the giant data center in the corner taking all the power. I think that's a bit disingenuous in terms of perception, but then we as a sector I think need to be more open and transparent to have that transparent about how we operate, what we do, and what we actually support. We talk about this ethereal thing called the digital economy and digital infrastructure. And I think people need to, the wider communities need to appreciate that actually translates to what you do on your iPads and phones. Mm-hmm. without the data, without the digital infrastructure, there is none of that. So, I think we need to be better at communicating that, being more open about what we get on with. And then also, I think, from a purely aesthetic point of view, looking at how our data centers can actually have a form or an architecture that actually supports or inspires, mm-hmm. much like museums do when they go into new areas, etc. And we're very keen on investigating those alternative forms, not just in terms of aesthetic, but also how can we actually enhance the passive nature of the data center, whether it's cooling, hydraulics, aerodynamics, that sort of thing, as well as creating interesting forms.
Right. Well, that's 5 minutes. You've just kind of covered almost everything in one go in multiple directions. these regulations, I mean, first of all, it's probably worth saying that the German one, data center companies are all multinational, so what happens in Germany matters to them. It's also one of the major four countries of data centers are being implemented in Europe. But in any case, the German data center law is really just the first tentacle of the implementation of the European Energy Efficiency Directive. So it is coming for all of us across the whole of Europe. And there are probably reasons to think that the German one is going to be quite an interesting and maybe typical example of how it gets implemented. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's been a very brave move by the German government from certain sectors. A very welcome move because it's actually drawing the line in the sand as to what this type of legislation might look like. So it's very useful in that regard. And I think it's not the complete package, as it were. And there are nuances of data centers and their sort of operation and performance that do need to be incorporated. And I think that's one side of that type of legislation. I think any type of legislation, the real question is, how is this going to be policed? What are the penalties around for non-compliance? I think that will evolve. Once the German experience, or the German pilot, let's call it, gets to a degree of maturity, I think that's when we'll start to see the EU and other countries starting to look at, okay, so what can we take from that and create a suitable legislation. I think the really interesting reason why people are sitting back is to see whether the legislation in Germany actually drives away data center development or data center operators from developing any more or continuing to operate in those locations. And I think, by and large, we go where our customers. And there is some argument. There is an argument to make that, well, it's already well established, Frankfurt and Berlin. So the likelihood of a transition away from that and lose all that capacity is not likely. And I can see mileage in that as well. But it's a really interesting inflection point at the moment as to this need for increasing transparency to give the sector credibility and actually evolving the legislation to a degree of maturity where it actually does what it's supposed to do without reducing the competitiveness of the location to attract data center operators and consumers.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, that's going to be a really interesting proof point. I mean, up until very recently, the data center industry was able to get by with, I want to say we're blustering, but that sounds a bit too negative, but basically saying, you know, we're only using a couple of percent of the electricity in Europe. You can spare us that because we're doing something so useful. And coming up with various ways of self-policing, like general agreements to try and get to a lower PUE, etc., in the hope that there wouldn't be regulations. And as the regulations became more likely, we started to hear people saying things like, you know, if you regulate data centers in one country, you'll drive them away. And as a sort of, we'll find out whether that was just a tactic to try and delay or avoid or water down the regulations, or whether it's an actual thing, whether we'll find data centers going to, I don't know, Scandinavia. Instead, I would say Scandinavia rather than Amsterdam or Paris or London, because they all have similar power constraint and they're likely to have similar regulations imposed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the flat D, the tier one locations, I think, you know, we've got to all acknowledge that they are urban contexts, right? They are established cities that have their own thrust. Economy and population. So, and it's a growing population, and we're seeing increasing urbanization across the board, across the world, and cities are getting bigger. So their footprint is increasing, their energy demand is increasing, because that's where all the jobs are for the time being. And you know, locating data centers in those locations is kind of creating that tension, and in a way raising the visibility. In a way, you could argue we're a victim of our own success, but I think you know. The line in the sand is being drawn now to actually say that we need to be more visible and transparent and actually have a credible narrative about, you know, why we do what we do and how we are actually moving to reduce our environmental impact. In a way, we are also fortunate in that we have, you know, the customer base that we have are some of the richest companies in the world. And they all have very visible and high value sustainability programs, which are contributing significantly. So I think, you know, that's the stuff that we should be leveraging off. And then actually it's time for us to step up and change the narrative, take control of the narrative, perhaps, and demystify. As I say, I keep saying, being transparent and credible about it, about what we do and how we do what we do, and more importantly, how we're going to reduce our environmental impact.
Right, because I mean, as a sort of basic question, how good are the regulations now, and how good are they likely to get? Because you've sort of alluded already to the fact that some of them, in some ways, seem to misunderstand parts of how data centers operate. They think a PUE figure is something that applies no matter how fully loaded a data center is, whereas we know differently. And they also, in an earlier draft of the German law, they seem to be suggesting that it was simply going to be possible for data centers to decide to reuse their heat. And to, you know, set a target for a percentage of heat to be reused, regardless of a whole lot of other things that need to be in place to do that. I mean, I'm sort of interested to know sort of how good these regulations are. What's the cause of the problems? Because I know that a lot of quite knowledgeable people with the right goals were involved in making this. You know, sort of what's making it? How can it be done better? How well is it? Is it at the moment?
I think we can communicate better about how our building operates, because there's a general tendency that it's a big grey box, and that's it, but it's actually probably the most technical building type that's out there. So the normal rules and regs don't apply. And if I was to pick a building type in the entire real estate sector that even comes close to the complexity that a data center has, I'd have to say it'd probably be a tall building. And then, you know, even a super tall building, the impacts and ramifications are very different, but the complexities are, I would say, are on a par. And I think as we get larger, due to forthcoming trends in the sector, I think we are going to have to look at how that our size actually contributes positively to the community, because we're no longer a little box in the corner. We're actually quite a massive 12-story box that's taking up a lot of space and power. I think, you know, making that explicit as well, you know, demystifying that and getting involved, because, you know, the other aspect of the legislation is that there have been a number of industry bodies being set up, like Climate Neutral Data Center Pact, etc., that we've all signed up to, which are all trying to achieve the same thing. And you could argue that that was us as a sector trying to self-police, and maybe they haven't been as successful. But I think the rather than the quality of the legislation, I think it's got to be the reduce the quantity of ways of either measuring yourself or reporting or et cetera, and actually come to a consistent and unified and agreed format that everybody can sign up to. But more importantly, it'll allow comparison of apples with apples so that we can, you know, that there is that transparency, and more importantly, the credibility coming from understanding how we operate and just what the building does, what it does.
Yep, good. I think I heard a marvellous collective intake of breath when you used again and again the word transparency there. That's not something that comes naturally to the data center industry.
It doesn't. And I think, you know, there's degrees of transparency, let's put it that way, that I think, and what we're transparent about. You know, we're not about saying, okay, so ABC customer is in here and they're consuming this and whatnot. That's not the aim of any of this legislation. It's actually saying, what's the performance of your building? Where is the transparency? And I think the companies that have got the sharpest, that make the sharpest intake of breath, have got probably the most to hide, either because the performance is shocking or they just don't have the data to back it. And I think that's that transparency piece I keep going on about is actually transparency, not just for the regulator, legislator, or the community, but also for ourselves. Because, you know, if you're not measuring your consumptions and your performance, how do you know where you sit as a building? How do you know how optimally you're running it? And so, if the legislation drives companies and operators to actually invest more in and be better at collecting and using data that they're of their performance, then I think it would be a good thing.
Right. Now it's time for a slight change of pace, going back to something we alluded to right at the beginning, electrical grids and what we might simplistically call a shortage of power. But you've got a history in this sector beyond data centers, so you can give us a bit more of a nuanced view of what's going on with the electric grids at the moment.
Thanks. Like I alluded to earlier, I think, you know, the whole low carbon transition is requiring us to be more, everything to be a lot more electrified. I think the basic network infrastructure is still either lacking in capacity or just dumb and needs to be smarter. And by dumb, I mean not smart, because nearly everything is smart these days, from smartphones to smart toasters, etc. And I think, you know, network operators have been a bit backward in coming forward into looking at that and seeing how that can happen. I think they are stuck between a rock and a hard place, because whilst a low carbon transition has been having for a few decades, they've got to sprint to catch up from where they should have been. And I think part of it is also that their response has been curbed by the electricity regulators, who really don't want to have the end user, us as individuals, picking up the cost for the infrastructure upgrade that's required. So I think legislation needs to evolve. A great example would be, you know, the situation in Ireland, where they've got gigawatts of renewables ready to go, but they can't plug into the grid. So there's no economic sense to build these things until your grid connection date is there. And it's pretty far down the line, as we're seeing in West London, et cetera. So I think, but the reason why, the thing that Airgrid was struggling with was the rate of investment it had to make And it was also somewhat limited by the fact that, you know, in Ireland, private wire isn't allowed. And actually, that simple legislation change can actually unlock a lot of private investment. And data center developers, data center operators, data center owners, you know, we all want power today and we want our data center operational now. And investment in power infrastructure is something that we all have to do. And by power infrastructure, I don't just mean on the LV side on site, but actually you have to extend your view now and actually look at where are the major points of connection, where are the bays on the high voltage network that I can plug into, and actually am I prepared to invest in building the overhead lines or underground lines to connect my data center up on time. It's a strategy I've executed a couple of times in the past. To do so, and it's an interesting conversation when you move up a voltage level from going from a district network operator to a transmission system operator. It becomes a very different conversation because the scale is so much higher, and I think there's the opportunity both for both sides, for both the data centers and the network operators, is that if data centers do want to be in that location and they do want gigawatts of power, then, you know, why don't the network operators and the regulator turn around and say, all right, if you guys want to do it, invest in the network, help us operate, help us build it, because then we're also doing a community effect. And don't just make us build enough for our building, make us build enough capacity or network bandwidth for the wider community, so that the network operators do have that ability to look at that private investment. There are many, many, so in the UK particularly, really nice little mechanisms and licensing regimes where by you can get an investment return on that network asset. So I think you've got to look laterally at it and actually have those open conversations. And I think certain locations lend themselves, because the legislative environment is perhaps of more, how should I put it, entrepreneurial, whereas others are a lot more centralized and a bit slower off the mark, but they will have to catch up. I think the electricity side, I think heat is a really interesting one. I think obviously there are certain countries that have established or developing heat networks, but the majority don't have a heat network per se, so it's going on a piecemeal basis. And I think the challenge with heat networks or data centers plugging their heat into heat networks is, when is that heat network going to be operational? So in Germany, most heat networks are established, and it's normally just an extension, versus, you know, if you look at central London, there are very few heat networks, and we all know how London is absolutely hate roads being dug up. But can you imagine having to dig up the road for a new heat network across the distances that it'd have to travel? So I think that lag. And then the other myth that we need to dispel, maybe be a bit more transparent about, is that, you know, yeah, we generate heat, but it's not what we call high quality heat or high temperature heat. So you can't run a whole heat network from one data center's heat. We either need to install a heat pump and put more energy in to increase the quality of the heat, increase the temperature, or the heat network needs to have some kind of heat source, whether it's a CHP or a energy from waste plant, etc., where there is a much higher temperatures and excessive heat. I think with heat, the other aspect that is still unknown beyond just a pure technical infrastructure is the commercial model around that, because clearly if you enter into a heat PPA, for argument's sake, then the expectation is that you will provide that level of quality of heat and that volume of heat consistently. And as we know, data centers, you know, okay, most of us are linked up, and once we're on, we're on. But there are occasions when they go down, or a customer leaves, or the data center needs to be refurbished or whatever, and then that falls away. And having a heat PPA where you're committed for 10, 15, 20 years can curb that development and can curb your flexibility. So, yeah, a lot of people are looking at how heat PPAs, or whether a heat PPA is even required, and do we just make that commitment initially and give it for free to see what happens, see what happens with the legislation around that.
I think we know kind of that giving it away for free with no agreement is never going to work, because as you say, you know, in 10 years time, you know, one of the biggest underlying problems here is, as you say, the time scale. You know, we're all tooled up to be able to build a data center in 18 months. Whereas, you know, within that timescale, a heat network would have more or less cleared one of the first levels of planning permission, maybe, possibly not even that. You know, a week or two back, we did have an announcement of a new district heating system in London, which will take heat from two data centres at least that aren't yet built and who don't want to give their names. And, you know, the timescale at which that's going to be built is way longer than the timescale the data centres got to open. And they might feel quite reasonably that, you know, from 10 years from now, they don't even know how much heat they'll generate. You know, past experience says it'll be more, but they say we found some new kind of silicon technology that does the work with less heat. They don't want to be constrained against using that because they've committed to reduce a certain amount of waste heat every year to the district heat network.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point. And, you know, heat reuse isn't just about plugging into a heat network. There are a multitude of heat reuse options that you could do on site, you know, from as a developer, our most valuable asset is land. So allocating space or allocating land that we've bought for heat reuse becomes an interesting balancing question. But there are some really neat ways of showing that you're reusing your heat and sharing your heat with more local uses. So having a heat offtaker nearby is always a great thing, but that's really location driven, where you can be location agnostic and you're prepared to allocate some of your throughout your red plot boundary area. You can do some clever stuff, which actually then, you know, goes back to the earlier point of engaging with the community. And one thing I really like are shallow geothermal with polytunnels to sort of provide that kind of opportunity to grow different yield crops and actually, you know, bring back an old idea of the allotment using it and actually allow the community allocate them small, you know, little gardens or plots within the greenhouses to grow whatever they want. So I think, yeah, there's some really nice little ways that you can do that to enamor yourself to the economy, to the community. And perhaps even the local economy, right? I think it's always got to be interesting. And then, you know, the other flip side of that is eliminate heat altogether by not generating it in the first place. So, you know, taking adaptive measures and maybe looking at immersion cooling, et cetera, and the like. I think with electricity, there's a lot more opportunity, particularly around the smart piece that I was talking about earlier. So I think smart grids and microgrids are going to be very interesting. And also looking at the entire power infrastructure typology that we have currently powers data centers and how we can actually be a bit smarter about that and optimize those designs and maybe embrace some out there ideas like no diesel gen sets, eliminate resilience altogether from diesel. Is there where we can and the like. So yeah, I think look at the box, look at the network, look at how the two come together, look at the interface between that, and see what you can do. And with heat, I think there's some really interesting storage techniques out there. But then the question is, once you've stored the heat, how do you get it back out and make it useful? So you know, physics can't be broken that way, really. So yeah, I think, and that's the hope you got to have is that there are some breakthrough technologies that come through. And you know, that breakthrough technology piece is a really interesting concept for me because I think, you know, if you look at you know, all the data center operators and owners, you know, we're all tech companies fundamentally, and the scale of that we operate with, the megawatts or gigawatts that we operate with, we could actually help nascent technology become very, very bankable very, very quickly. Because as long as the technology does what it says on the tin, rather than looking for venture capital and then the sales piece, if it ties up with the data center operator or a couple or the data center sector as a whole, we can provide that scale for that technology to become so widespread and across our portfolios, bring the levelized cost down, and then it actually allows further innovation for that technology to then move into other sectors, whether it's consumer or further industrial. So I think that's that we could be a real force for good in that regard to help accelerate renewable, certain clean tech to market.
Right. A proving ground and an area of commercialization. Yeah. You mentioned breakthrough technologies, so I guess we should talk about AI. I think all webinars, presentations should mention AI. And I think the power impact of AI gets less coverage than a lot of the other parts of it. But it's going to be very significant, isn't it?
Yeah, I think partly because of just the scale that's being forecast required. And I think it's been important to be clear about what we mean in terms of the AI impact on data centers. I think on the one hand, more megawatt space is going to be required, but that's actually for the learning component of it. Similarly, the actual application where, you know, you need zero latency will probably be facilitated by centers that are much closer to the center or even the edge. So I think, and the fact that the learning AI element is the bigger part of it, doesn't require such low latency, so it can actually be further out or perhaps outside of the normal availability zones around the cities, which should help reduce some of the pressures on the cities, the urban that we're in, and maybe go a bit further out to other locations and other cities where there is a lot of land and a lot of either renewable energy or power, where the grid is perhaps underutilized. So I think that's the interesting aspect of AI for me. One thing I haven't seen, and just thinking out aloud here, is because the other big energy consumer is obviously crypto mining. The energy consumption of that is quite ridiculous, but I'd love to see a comparison between what crypto mining does versus AI and which of the two is
more. You need to talk to Alex DeVries, the DigiEconomist. There's there's a basic news story and a podcast with him on DCD. Basically, he was the first guy to do the to measure and check the energy use of crypto mining, and he's done the same job using different methods to estimate how much energy AI is going to use. And just based on the number of GPUs that NVIDIA is planning to produce, if they're all powered up and used in the year 2030, we'll have got to a stage, if I remember correctly, where Bitcoin has got to. Yeah, the amount of energy use of AI is predicted to ramp up to a similar level, which is actually quite scary.
Well, it's cumulative, right, isn't it? So you've got the problem you've got is it's not Bitcoin mining and then AI. We've got Bitcoin mining and AI being added to it. So you've got this cumulative aspect, and I think that's where, you know, the real impact on the energy increase is going to be. I think, you know, the other aspect of it, though, is that with that much demand, energy demand, there is now very, very strong business cases for renewables, right? And this idea of 24/7 renewable energy. So I think, again, to earlier about being a force for good, when you've got that much demand, you've got actually, you could leverage that to actually encourage investment, et cetera. Because as we look at it at NTT, is that we'd like to think that with the demand that we have in locations where we are, where perhaps the renewables or the clean tech space is more nascent than other areas, that we could actually help facilitate that acceleration.
I mean, are we facilitating or are we likely to just use it all up? Is there actually going to be enough renewable energy?
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe that's the change in mindset that we've got to look at, is not just get enough for ourselves or, you know, any future proofing, but actually how much more do we need for the community? Do we want to contribute or do we want to be seen to do it? And perhaps, you know, planning permitting can be linked to that as well. So there is an upside for actually making that investment. There has to be a return. Mm-hmm. We're not charities by any stretch of the imagination. But we can be a force for good, but there has to be a motivation for us to do that. So I think that's where the legislation and government has to catch up with us. And you know, as I mentioned earlier, the private sector is more than capable of doing it itself. Right? If the legislation allows, if the environment, if the legislative context is there, and you're savvy enough to take advantage of it, I think, you know, there is a lot of how do I put this, consortia that could be created that not only operates and builds data centers, but does network infrastructure investment, as well as the renewable energy generation piece as well. So I think that's really interesting. I mean, the for all the networks and everything like that, I think demand side response is really interesting. Area for data centers to get involved in now to actually be a good grid citizen. So whether we turn down ourselves in times of pressure or we get paid to do so, I think the issue there is that twofold. One, not every country has a mature demand side response market. And in my humble opinion, I think the UK probably has the most sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Germany is catching up very quickly, and the rest of Europe is starting to roll that out. But North America is starting to, in certain states, you know, offer demand side response mechanisms and the like. Mm. And I think that's going to be really interesting and quite valuable. And it will also motivate operators and owners to actually start looking at, to my point earlier about changing the power infrastructure typology. How can we capture to provide that resilience to the grid, not just ourselves? And then the flip side of it is, I think also, you know, changing the perception of the plant that is critical infrastructure, whether it's the resilience, the backup stuff, allowed to enter into those markets. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence of, I'll give you one example. There's a football stadium, a Premier League football team that was hosting a match, and they suffered a massive blackout. And they tried to fire up their backup Jennies, and their backup Jennies didn't fire up because they cut out all of the O&M scheduling as a cost saving exercise. So the the match had cancelled, and you know that team, that hosting team, had to foot the bill for not just only the missed game, but the new game as well. They pretty quickly looked at demand side response to sort of say, well, okay, we could put up some generators into this as a way of keeping the O&M up to, you know, keeping up with our O&M requirements for our generators. I think that's those are the sorts of things that we should be looking at.
Yes. But I think that's very clear. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think AI, sorry, I know we've deviated and come back to it. And people who know that that's how I think, but with AI, I think what's really also potentially interesting is how AI could be used to help optimize the operations of a data center. I don't know, some kind of central processing unit where the AI is looking at all of that, monitoring the data, etc., looking at the loads and actually saying, okay, well, we can allocate here, linked up with the grid consumption, with the carbon consumption, with the low carbon energy consumption, etc., and coordinate across all of those aspects to actually lower the footprint of the amount and carbon footprint of the DC. And I think that's a really interesting, if you will, operational optimization using AI, which you know, I think is very interesting.
Yes, it's talked about quite often, but in a way that to me is quite surprisingly vague. You know, it was, I think, 7 or 8 years ago, Google said they'd applied AI to optimize the cooling of their data center in Singapore. And they gave some quite sort of definite figures about how much energy they'd save. You know, it was in the region of like sort of 5-10% or something. And they then said, and we're happy to share this result with everybody else if they want to know how to do it. Mm. And then everything went silent. We just haven't heard from them. They haven't shared good algorithms to do this. And, you know, we now kind of think maybe they were being a bit optimistic about what they said they could do. But as a general thing, I kind of always think that those ideas of using AI to improve performance of a data center are only going to like shave a few percent off, which is it's got to be good. Maybe I'm expecting too much to think that it might do more, or maybe I'm, you know, tending to panic into thinking we need it to do more.
I think it comes with scale, right? And, you know, we talk about data centers being digital infrastructure, and we've talked about networks of power and heat. But actually, it strikes me that, to the point, the AI may only be able to elicit 3 or 4, 5, 10% optimization of a single data center. But if it was able to operate across a network of data centers, every data center in Frankfurt was somehow interconnected into this energy data center operating system, for example, that was using AI. 10% across all of those data centers soon adds up to quite a significant load. And, you know, that's where I think, to my point earlier about networks, electricity networks being dumb, if they became smart and, you know, were able to facilitate that kind of networking, network scaling, where you've got your nodes and you're scaling across it through the electrical network, then that could actually help with a lot of the using more with less, and actually may negate even the need for new infrastructure, because you're just managing everything so much better across multiple nodes of the network in that city or in that location. I think that's kind of utopia to my mind, and actually very complex, and I have no idea how it'd be achieved, but it strikes me that's potentially one way where AI can actually help with that. Achieve meaningful reductions that actually move the needle, rather than, as you say, just skirt around the sides of about 5-10%.
I think that sounds very true. And I think for that to happen, we probably need to move some of the things that we were talking about earlier to actually get grids that can allow it to happen, and regulations that can allow the grids to do that. You know, I mean, one of the things you're talking about, sort of demand response and grid interactive data centers in Ireland, there's a growing idea that your backup power should be available to the grid when it's needed. And we've just seen in America a sort of a large project in Maryland. Sorry, we should be talking about Europe here, but it's put in jeopardy because the backup power is so large. They're looking at these as nasty things that are sitting there doing nothing for anyone else, because in that particular state, it's actually illegal for those backup power systems to send any power outside the location where they're at. I think, there's a lot of areas where we need to move on to more sophisticated ways of looking at things. Whether we need AI to do that sophistication, I don't know. So the answer really is kind of bringing this smartness into the integration of everything, perhaps. I mean, we need smarter regulations, we need smarter grids, and we need smarter data centers, which possibly AI may be able to give us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the smart aspect of it manifests itself in ultimately the smart city, which in my mind, I think data centers are potentially a catalyst and a hub for smart cities. And it's an area that we're looking at very closely with the smart platform division within NTT, about how we can integrate some of their technologies into the way we look at our data centers, and even offering smart city deployment for cities that we're going into. I think what's really very interesting from a power perspective is that when you start talking to the hyperscalers, et cetera, who are renowned for building operating systems, and you start talking about smart cities and related to sort of like an energy operating system, you know, we do need to digitize the electricity grid. That's that transition from dumb to smart. And I think, you know, an energy OS would be fascinating. And again, the data center could represent a node in that. And then escalating even further towards the city, the concept of an urban OS, where all of the verticals from transport through to health, water, power, and heat, etc., are all kind of digitized and you know, operate under a system that an OS that actually is looking at optimizing and doing more with less, and really taking that into its next evolution. So I think there's cause for a lot of hope. I think the key point is that, yes, there's a lot more data centers and larger scale, but then the way I see it is the scale of our ambition and the scale of the number of stakeholders and the scale of opportunity increases as well, and it requires that more holistic view, incorporating the local community, the city that you're in, potentially the region that you're in as well. And it's only when you get to that sort of level of integration across those different levels of scale do you actually start to perhaps see the real impact reduction, environmental impact reduction, that will move the needle. I like to think that we're at the forefront of that, and hope to drag along kicking and screaming out of my colleagues and competitors.
You're making it sound like a real big effort, but one that's going to be very worthwhile doing. And I think we're going to need quite a lot of smart people to help get us along the way of this. So thanks for joining us and telling us about your ideas for how we're going to evolve towards smarter grids, smarter regulations, and smarter and better data centres. Been really good talking to you, Neil. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Sustainability is no longer a nice to have. It's a priority. Vertiv Power, cooling and IT management solutions for critical infrastructure, are designed to reduce the use of energy, water, and space. From innovative liquid cooling to dynamic grid services, we work hand in hand with customers to enable them to meet their data center sustainability goals. Visit us at vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Thanks for listening to the Zero Downtime podcast, brought to you in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical digital infrastructure provider. Don't forget to like this podcast and subscribe to our channel. We'll see you again next time.